So the pitching might actually be terrible. I mean, we don't know, but it could be a huge weakness there. And if it is, then they're going to be, they're going to be just another non-contending team. And that would be taken with a lot of bitterness here. The romance around the Cubs, I think, is largely a thing of the past. It's not that it's cynical, but it's as cynical here around surrounding that team. And I'm really talking about Cubs fans, as I think it is when the Yankees don't deliver, or the Red Sox don't deliver, or any other, the Cardinals don't deliver. The only way to really make good on everything for the Cubs would be to be better than expected, more than meets the eye. It was a different vibe around the Cubs, and it has only kind of gotten more tense. So, yeah, fragile is a good word for it.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, and joining me this week is Steve Greenberg, sports columnist at the Sun-Times. I asked him if I could call him verbal pugilist. He is a former St. Louis resident, correct, and now up slinging ink and pounding on keyboards up in Chicago, where he's been covering the Cubs camp, right? That's the camp that you've been at most, Steve?
I've been at the Cubs, yeah. No White Sox yet. I did Sox in spring training, and I'll do them here and there during the season for sure. They're a great story. I think they're more interesting than the Cubs, but I've been at the Cubs. We're in between beat writers. Your pal Gordon Whitmire out and in a new job, and a guy named Russ Dorsey from MLB.com starting on the 20th, and so I've been doing it until then. I'll sort of peel off maybe right before the season and start doing both.
What's kind of the vibe at Cubs camp this week?
I think it's pretty good. They might be the only team in the league that haven't had a player test positive for coronavirus yet. So for one thing,
Wow.
I think there's that doesn't feel to them like just a coincidence. They're proud of it. I hear that word a lot on these video conference calls we're all reporting on, interviewing managers and players on. There's a feeling that a collective effort has contributed to that and signified the way they're approaching this season. I think they think they're going to be good, that they're a veteran team that can lean on that attribute, and so it's a pretty good vibe. And something funny happened Thursday night at scrimmage. Anthony Rizzo had a stiff back and wasn't able to play. And there's a 6-game scrimmage going on the field, and every inning or so, you'd hear this noise coming from somewhere in an otherwise empty ballpark. And it was Rizzo in uniform carrying a bat around the stadium, popping up in different sections of the stands and just heckling. So at one point he's up high, if you could picture, up high in the top row of the bleachers, and you just hear, "You suck." And with Rizzo, he kept heckling Kyle Schwarber. And in another inning, Derek, this was really funny. Schwarber goes out to take his position, and all of a sudden you see he's startled, and Rizzo was lying down on the warning track against the ivy, just kind of waiting for him, and then spent half an inning in that position and seeming to heckle Schwarber the whole time. So there's that sort of spring training element of fun that is part of what they're doing now. But they've got to get serious, obviously. 2 weeks till opening day.
Yeah, as we're recording this, 2 weeks till opening day, Cardinals open at home against the Pirates, and the Cubs have the Brewers, correct?
The Cubs have the Brewers, yep.
And there are 27 of the 30 teams that have had a positive test, so the Cubs are one of three during the intake testing that did not have a positive coronavirus test. And that certainly gives them a health edge when you look around the division as to some of the people. Like, the Cardinals are still waiting on some of the pitchers that they were counting on contributing to, particularly the bullpen, now that they have the answer with Carlos Martinez in place. That was
right.
That was the biggest question, as he waited and waited and waited. He was caught up in the delay of testing.
Yeah.
The Cardinals had him go through multiple tests. His did not come back as promptly as expected, which added another day to his weight and another day to the Cardinals' uncertainty about his role. The Cubs also went through that, right? Didn't they have to postpone or cancel a practice because their tests were delayed?
They had to push the schedule back. They didn't cancel it, but they just pushed everything back a couple of hours, waiting for tests, I think, that were administered Sunday. So this would have been 2 days later, Tuesday, if I recall correctly, and things were just off schedule. But, you know, like in a lot of camps, there were players who were made it clear that this was indicative of a problem that had been ongoing to that point. Chris Bryant said there were some guys who had tested, I think, the previous Sunday and didn't get results until 7, 8, 9 days later. He wasn't one of them, but, you know, he was speaking on their behalf, and he himself, I think, had to wait 4 or 5 days. There was a lot of that, obviously, in baseball, as MLB explained it, you know, that this was before they were officially moving to every other day testing. I don't know if that was their intention from the start, but that's kind of how they at least spun out of the criticism they were getting from their own guys. Right.
As you heard Chris Bryant kind of describe that, did your doubts intensify? Did your doubts surface of this season? How do you feel after this first week of summer camp, quote unquote, the likelihood of a season is?
Yeah. I would expect that what'll happen will be, I don't know. I think they're going to start it as scheduled and go as long as they can. I mean, I'm very skeptical, you know, about whether it's possible to complete a whole season, because doesn't it only take one team whose coronavirus situation kind of spins out of control to affect the rest of the league? And I guess we, you know, we have to think of how we define what it would take to make a team really reassess, make the league really reassess and pull back on games as scheduled. You know, how many does it take? Is it a matter of, you know, who tests positive or how many? And, you know, numbers wise, I would think that you know, you're carrying 60 players, you can keep switching out players if you need to. But if there's if there's an outbreak in one camp, then everybody's got to shut it down. So I'm skeptical. I mean, you know, I'm skeptical about all sports. I don't think baseball's unique in any way. Maybe it's more conducive to being able to squeeze in a season in baseball than it is in basketball or football, just because of the nature of the contact and all that sort of stuff. But baseball's right. Going first. So, you know, kind of going full bore first. And I think it's, you know, it's nerve wracking for everybody involved. Yeah. How are you feeling?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I was asked on a radio show here recently, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being for certain there'd be a World Series and 1, it doesn't get off the ground or doesn't even get to opening day. And I said, well, it's really not that linear, because you figure the first week is going to be the bumpiest, because players who had no clue, were asymptomatic, had no idea, no reason to go be tested, are getting tested. And so you're going to see this wide spike in positives, and then baseball will isolate and quarantine and adjust. But after that, the bubble's defined, right? The people who they're counting on, the people who have passed the tests, who aren't carrying the virus or have the antibodies, are in the bubble. And from there, it becomes, how do you avoid puncturing that bubble? Because that bubble's going to start moving around the country from city to city. That's one thing that baseball's trying that the other sports are not, is this taking the game home. Yeah, travel. Be in the city where you're from. Be a part of, whether it's a reopening or whether it's just be part of the available entertainment, but identify with the city. So once that bubble starts moving, it can remain a bubble regardless of where it goes. You know, talking with an expert, he was like saying, look, you know, the virus might be spiking in Los Angeles, but if you remain true to a bubble, it really doesn't matter if you're at a hotel in St. Louis or a hotel in Los Angeles or a hotel on the moon. What matters is if you walk outside that bubble, and if you're in an area where it's spiking, then your chances of contracting it are that much better. And then the bubble comes apart, and then it happens the way you describe it. Like, is it a five-man rotation going on the COVID-19 IL that undoes a team? Is it an entire team that has to go into quarantine for 14 days and call up a roster from its satellite camp? You know, I mean, all those questions are sort of under the purview of that competitive integrity, Steve.
Right.
And at what point is it not there for the league to continue? I think the worry is that it's not players going into quarantine or players going on to the COVID-19. It's someone going on a respirator. It's someone going to the hospital that will awaken baseball.
Absolutely. It's not at all, you know, unprecedented that a young person or even a young fit person gets really sick from this. So gets gravely ill or dies. I mean, it you're so right. I mean, so much is being done under the assumption that our players, our professional athletes, if they get sick, they're out for a routine period. They quarantine. If it takes 2 weeks, then they're back. But that won't be the experience for everybody. Cubs have a 38-year-old pitching coach who played in the majors, Tommy Hotovy, great shape, looks like he could be a player. He was sick with coronavirus, went 30 days in between positive tests, and he nearly went on a respirator. He developed pneumonia. He was just extremely sick, lost 20 pounds. There's no way he would have come back within the confines of a 2.5 month season. You know,
wow.
he would have been, you know, certainly would have been done, but he was in a rough spot, unable to complete a, you know, Zoom call. He tried to get in a couple meetings and it was too much for him as he quarantined at home, and he was in a bad way. And, so if it could happen like that with him, it could certainly happen like that with a lot of players in baseball. So, and the NBA and, you know, the other leagues.
What's the feel like at Wrigley Field? I mean, you described Anthony Rizzo going around. You know, you have a somewhat new looking press box, correct?
Yeah, I was going to say, I know it's obnoxious to people who don't sit in press boxes when we talk about press boxes, but you'll be amazed when you get there. And that's not that it's state of the industry. It's still the Wrigley Field press box. It's subpar, but it's not the worst. It's kind of comfortable. So it's cooler. You know, the airflow situation is better and more comfortable. So it's not bad, and it looks nice from the outside. It doesn't look like it's about to fall down.
I always kind of like the treehouse aspect of it, though, to be honest. Like, I kind of like it.
It's got a charm.
You know, there's a football field in Louisiana when I was covering high school football down there, where I arrived to cover a game. There was one really standout stud player on the team. I believe it was Independence, if my memory serves me correctly, Independence High. And I asked where my seat was, and they pointed over to a telephone pole. And I'm like, okay. And then I looked up the telephone pole, and it had like a little, I mean, I guess it wasn't an actual telephone pole, but that kind of style of pole. And it had like a box situated on top of it, like we would have built in a tree. And I had to ladder on up to it and sit there. It was both awesome and also uncomfortable. And I also was like a gust of wind knocks me down, right? That's how this feels. But Wrigley always kind of had that charm to it that I felt like maybe I ought to take a ladder to it.
That decrepit charm where, you know, any game, anything can happen on the field and anything can fall down on you from overhead. And a major spider issue, right? Over the years.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Major spider issue.
So yeah. I don't know what happens with that, but there don't appear to be any openings in the walls and ceilings. Maybe that's done too. It's nicer. You'll be happier there, but it's not as nice as the one at Bush. I like that press box. I don't know how you feel about it, but I think that's a good one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's functional. We're in it. There was some question as to whether or not that's where we would watch these practices, cover these games from, but that is where we're at. We're social distanced and all wearing our masks. I would imagine it's similar at Wrigley. Does it give is there still the collegial feel of the press box?
Yeah, I think so. There are, what's the number? I think there are 26 seats available with distancing right now inside the box. There's a number 35. I don't recall what the significance was to that. I think that the functional day-to-day right now during camp is there maybe 26 seats available. So the Wrigley press box, as we know, is smaller than many others, has fewer seats.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel full at all or empty, kind of in between, but people are still able to turn and yell, you know, shout something at whoever else is in it. There's still that element to it of conversation, ready conversation that does not exist in a lot of places just because they're more spread out.
Right. So the masks haven't been a filter for the sarcasm is what you're telling
me. Right. No. Everybody's been great about the masks, but a lot of complaining too. And still, right. You still have the same cast of characters being loud and appropriate, et cetera.
Like the two Muppets in the balcony. That's how I always feel there.
Right.
Statler and Waldorf.
I can assure you I would not have gone up to that so-called box in Louisiana, by the way. I would have brought the whole operation down, and there's no way I would have gotten up there. No chance.
You would have just paced the sidelines.
Yeah, I would have just quit.
I was much younger. It was like 22 years ago, so I was spry and wily and ready to go on up. Let me tell folks about our sponsor here at the Bus Podcast in Baseball. Imagine your home totally organized. Closet by Design specializes in custom closets, pantries, laundry room, garages, and more. Now get 40% off plus an additional 15% off. That's Closet by Design, 314-733-9855, 314-733-9855. The official sponsor of the Best Podcast in Baseball, Closets by Design. Steve, I wanted to have you on as part of what has become a tour of the new division alignment. Teams will still be playing for the National League Central title, but thrown into the mix are 20 games against the American League Central, and you're positioned there to see both the Cubs and know about the Sox. The Cardinals will face the Sox in the cornfield in Iowa if the season gets that far, and I wondered what your thoughts were on that. I mean, that to me does have potential to be magical. I mean, people will watch. If they build it, will people be able to come? We're not so sure yet, but that game could be pretty spectacular as far as symbolism goes.
I agree. It could be moving, kind of gorgeous and solemn at once and exciting. So I hope it happens. What a spectacle, and a great television spectacle, I think. So could be just just what the doctor ordered for baseball at that time when it comes, if it comes.
What kind of team will the Cardinals be facing there in the White Sox? Are they a different team in a 60 game sprint? Are they a contender in 2020 as opposed to a team building towards 2021?
Well, everybody's telling us that every team is a contender for a 60 game season.
Yeah, but we know better. I mean, we've seen a lot of baseball.
The White Sox are very talented. If you think about what the Cubs did in their rebuild and how all of a sudden all these young prospects bubbled up, guys with obvious talent. The Sox are on that track, but I think they've arguably put more pieces together and added, overhauled really, their pitching rotation. So maybe you could look at the White Sox and say, best case scenario, they are prepared to kind of deliver a year ahead of schedule, much as the Cubs did in 2015. When, of course, it took Jake Arrieta having one of the great seasons ever for that team to actually do all it did and get to the playoffs and win in the playoffs too. the White Sox, you know, let's assume they won't have anybody with a Jake Arrieta-like season, but they've got so much talent. It's impressive. And home run hitting talent. So, you know, just to kind of break it down, you know, people still know Jose Abreu, right? He's a power hitting first baseman who's been there for a long time, and they've added Edwin Encarnacion. So people know him because he's been around for 100 years hitting homers, but their young guys are Eloy Jimenez, who they got from the Cubs in a trade. And he is, you know, one of the top offensive prospects to come to Chicago in a long time, kind of like their Chris Bryant, if you want to put it like that. And Luis Robert, the center fielder, is a top one or two prospect, and he's going to be the starting center fielder on opening day. And Yoan Moncada was the top prospect in baseball when they traded Chris Sale to the Red Sox and got him. He kind of had a breakout season last year. He's a switch-hitting infielder with every tool. So, you know, you don't know who's going to really deliver and who's not, but you've got those guys. You've got Tim Anderson, who exploded at shortstop, won the batting title last year. Lucas Giolito at the front of the rotation was an all-star last year and I think is really terrific. They added Dallas Keuchel, Gio Gonzalez to a stable of arms that are just plain impressive. They've got all these power arms. They're a big, you know, they're a get off the bus and make your jaw kind of drop type of team. A bunch of big guys, power arms, but they're young. And so they think they're going to win. They think they're going to win a World Series. You know, they might not be ready yet. But I find the White Sox to be exciting, fun, and to have all those things the Cubs had, and maybe more from a baseball standpoint. What they don't have, what they've never had, and you know, is the exposure, the Wrigley Field, the media darling status, the kind of national team status that the Cubs have. So it'll happen with less fanfare, but I really do think the White Sox are on track to be a division winner, if not this year, then next. And to just be fun as heck to watch. They're going to hit a lot of homers. If this were a full season, I'd say, you know, you want a team that can challenge what the Twins did in the home run department last year. It's the White Sox. So they're going to be fun. And they can hit it deep into the corn.
And there'll be like little windows in the field, in the outfield walls, I'm told, so you can kind of see through it to the corn. So. You know, hopefully that carries on. That's an interesting like comparison because, you know, the Twins really stand out as the class of that AL Central team. Sure. You know, you mentioned all the home runs they hit last year, and then they go and add Josh Donaldson. And looking through the picks that we have to make for our season preview section, which we're still going to do, which is fantastic, you know, that we're going to be able to do that even after all this time and put out that special section. But, you know, I was like, wait a minute, could the Twins actually win the American League? I mean, you look at their lineup and, you know, they added Josh Donaldson. You look at their pitching staff and it's like, yeah, that might actually be really good in a short season. They got a lot going for them. And I find that comparison with the White Sox interesting because like you mentioned, like Lucas Giolito, man, imagine, I mean, you don't predict what Arrieta did or say what Flaherty did in the second half last season, but man, a Lucas Giolito who finds his rhythm and gets hot, and what kind of 10-game stretch could he have? You know, Dallas Keuchel, what kind, if he gets a feel for his cutter and sinker pretty quickly, what kind of 10-game stretch could he have? And, you know, you start saying, okay, well, look, if they catch the wave just right as a group, you know, it's going to be hard to slow a team down that doesn't know any better in a 60-game stretch that doesn't have to deal with, say maybe the meat grinder of a marathon.
I think you're right. You could see how it's good or bad for any type of team. But, you know, in the White Sox case, if they start fast, yes. I mean, there's no reason they can't win 40 games out of 60 and just light it on fire. If they start slowly, you know, maybe a young team with some guys who are really feeling themselves, maybe they sort of fracture, fall apart. Could happen either way. You could say the same about the Cubs, who traditionally start slowly. Maybe not, you know, or some of their hitters seem to start slowly. But they feel like as a veteran team, it suits them. So, I mean, really, we haven't seen a season like this before. Whoever starts fast is, you know, it's good to be a rabbit in 2020, right?
I mean, yeah.
And, I mean, how good were
the Pirates? Don't be the Nats.
Weren't the Pirates good last year in the first half, or at least for a while? I feel like they were.
For a little while, yeah.
For a little while. I mean, you don't think they're any good. But in that grouping of the NL Central and the AL Central, you've got a lot of teams that are capable. The Twins, I would think, are the favorite of if you lump those. I know it doesn't really work like that, but if you lump those 10 teams together, Minnesota looks the most complete. I think that's obvious. But, you know, I mean, I like what the Cardinals have with the pitching always, and like what the White Sox have with the brash talent. So, yeah, it's fun and so different. I'm kind of excited about it. I don't know. I'm kind of curious. Just might be more fun than expected. I hope so. I mean, there'll be the backdrop of constant tension and anxiety too, which is not great. But.
Yeah, that's right. That's what you talked about with the Field of Dreams trip, is that, you know, hopefully that game visually, and I think you used a good word, is hopefully that moment, that, you know, or that the whole evening has a solemn tone as opposed to a haunting tone.
Right.
And that's that line that it has to walk. And there's a lot of that, you know, like you walk the line of, all right, celebrate the 60 games, but not to a point where all of a sudden it becomes a distraction or feels like normalcy, right? You have to constantly remind yourself that there's a reason why it's 60 games, and that reason hasn't ended, and vigilance has to persist.
Right. That's the word that was in my head just as you said it, vigilance. That's a new muscle that all these people involved are going to have to really learn how to exercise and could make people make everybody a little better, you know, a little more highly evolved by the end, hopefully.
Maybe less, more selfless.
Yeah. It's kind of what I'm thinking. It's a real time lesson in humanity and selflessness and community. And both, you know, in a broad sense, baseball, the sports world, but within each team, it's the exact opposite of 25 players, 25 cabs, whatever that expression is, you know.
Oh yeah, the Mets, right?
I think that the Yankees or the Mets.
Yankees! It was the Yankees. It was the Reggie Jackson Yankees. You're right. You're right.
Yeah. Exactly. By the way, one more note on the White Sox, because I forgot to mention what might be the most important name, which is they kind of got their, you know, I mean, St. Louis appreciates a good catcher, right? They've got Yasmani Grandal. So they added him to James McCann, who was an all-star catcher last year. They've got a heck of a catcher core. And Grandal, I think, you know, as good as anybody, impactful, you know, on a pitching staff as anybody there is. His work in LA made that clear, in Milwaukee too, the things people say about him, the way they talked about him at White Sox camp in Arizona. So he's a mm-hmm. he's a key piece too. Just wanted to make sure I mentioned him.
No, I'm glad you brought it up, and I want to revisit that, but first you mentioned the starting center fielder, and his name echoes throughout St. Louis still as the prospect not signed, the one that they didn't get, the one they missed on, the superstar international player that they felt they had a good chance to sign, that internally he had a lot of champions, and there were folks pushing within the Cardinals front office to meet the price that he commanded and do whatever it took to get him, because he was that kind of talent, that kind of rare talent. The Sox pulled it off. How have you seen Robert's development? And I mean, what kind of player could he truly be?
First of all, your listeners shouldn't feel too bad. He's only going to be the next Mike Trout, according to multiple players on the White Sox. They call him Trout.
They call him Trout.
So that's not that good. How's he developing? I mean, I went and watched him in double A did a feature on him last year. And watched him at the, you know, the rookie, the prospects game at the MLB All-Star game. That's where, you know, where I've seen him, that in a little bit of spring training. He does look different. You know, it doesn't really matter. You can't base it on, you know, you got to watch a guy play every day, see how he handles success and handles failure and all those things. But he's just, I can't stress enough. He's like a Greek god. You know, he looks beautiful. He is the most put together athlete I've seen in baseball in a long time. So whatever that's worth, start there. He can run. He's got, you know, enormous power, and he can just cover ground, center field. He looks like, you know, a rare talent on a team that is athletically impressive, physically impressive to look at. He stands out. He's the most of those things. So, you know, I think you start there. He projects this kind of boundless potential. Doesn't always work out, right? We know that.
Right.
So, you know, he's got to do it. And I don't know if it's fair to judge him on whatever he does or doesn't do in this strange truncated season. You know, he might be more inclined to really break out in 2021. If you look at the White Sox recent history, Yoan Moncada had a terrible first season in the big leagues. I think might have led the league in strikeouts. Tim Anderson was really bad before he got really good. So Eloy last year, you know, really struggled in the batting average department. He hit 30 homers.
Right.
So young guys tend to not come in and go like gangbusters, like Chris Bryant did in Chicago, and, you know, won Rookie of the Year. I don't know if Luis Robert at his age is ready for that. You know, he didn't play a lot of minor league ball. He's kind of right up from a double A season to the big leagues. And he was in A ball early last year. So, you know, he's on a fast track.
Yeah.
May or may not be ready, but his talent is such that I know the White Sox feel like, you know, he is the cornerstone of it all. If, in as much as we have one guy, you know, we're building this whole thing around, I think they feel like it's him. And on a team with, you know, whose prospect rankings were at the top of baseball, that says a lot to me. So, well, sky's the limit for Luis Robert, and that is how he says it, he pronounces it Robert, even though I think if he's completely honest, you roll that R, sounds a little bit different, more like Robert. You know, but
it's just easier to pronounce it out.
My point being, it's not Robert. Everybody for some reason seems to want to say Robert, but that's wrong.
Okay. Yeah, that's how we were first introduced to him, was Robert, with a little R roll. But like I said, I mean, Trout is easier to pronounce. So if his nickname is Trout, then he's the big fish on the White Sox team.
Right. Imagine lugging that nickname around. Who, you know, that's not a lot.
No pressure.
No. It's like being called Gould.
What's that?
It's like being called Gould, you know, for someone in our profession.
Yeah, that's not true. It's like someone being called Whitmire in our profession.
Well, let's not talk about him. He ditched the Sun.
He's going to be so Robert. I messed up there. All right. So lesson learned. Luis Robert is going to be in a prominent spot in the field. How prominent is he going to be in the lineup?
He might lead off, but I don't think we know that yet. That's to be determined. But that was what, you know, they projected him as. He led off at double A, and, you know, there was a lot of talk that eventually he would do that for the White Sox. The obvious sort of alternative would be Tim Anderson, right? A batting champion who can run and isn't a real power bat, but he doesn't like to lead off. He might wind up being used there, tried there. And then another White Sox prospect who may or may not be part of the roster to start the season, but is certainly projected as a middle infielder, the second baseman of the future, likely opening day guy next year at least, is Nick Madrigal, who was a college player at Oregon State and had a really good career there, first-round pick. And he he seems like a leadoff guy. I would think he's in it would at least be hoped that he's the leadoff guy of the future for the White Sox. So it's fluid where Robert will bat.
So I want to tie it together real quickly for the Cardinals, or to the Cardinals. Nick Madrigal is actually a former high school teammate of Dylan Carlson, the Cardinals' top prospect. So Nick Madrigal went to Elk Grove High School, played for Dylan Carlson's dad, and those two are pals. And there's somewhat of a race between the two to get to the majors. They're lined up to do so. Now, Dylan came out of high school. Nick, as you mentioned, came out of college. So there's that. He's older, and Dylan could debut, likely will debut at some point in time in the season. It'll be really interesting how they massage the service time, Chris Bryant style, with him, especially considering they're weighing 60 games against 162. So the math has changed. Steve, right. I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned, Yasmani Grandal, who's from Havana, Cuba, Juan Mercado, also from Cuba, Jose Abreu, was part of the Goodwill tour that I got invited on to Havana. And, he was there to be reunited with his son as part of this group that went to see about Major League Baseball going to Havana. And eventually they did to play that game. It was fascinating to watch Abreu on the phone, pacing the hallways of the hotel as he waited for the car that was bringing his son for him to see. Just a really moving moment that I'll never forget.
Wow.
How much of, they have a really strong Cuban identity going there. And it seems like that may have played into them being able to then also bring in Robert.
I think it did for sure. There was a dinner that was, I guess, at the heart of it all, of the recruitment, and it meant a lot to all involved, especially Robert. And like a lot of guys in that locker room, but especially the Cuban players, Jose Abreu is just a towering figure. I imagine it to be Yadi Molina-like, although I don't know Yadi as well. But, they all call him Pito, and they look up to him, and he carries a big stick in that clubhouse. And so I think he's a good dude, Abreu, kind of virtuous in a baseball sense, and key to it all. So if they lose Abreu, which was speculated about, and
yeah.
You really are risking a lot. So they re-signed him, and I think it was a great move. They need him for those interpersonal reasons that can be a really big deal in sports, and certainly in a baseball clubhouse where you got a mashup of backgrounds. And so he is a key guy on that team, and in as much as they have a leader of the team, it's really, it's really been him. And I think Grandal enhances that in a dramatic way. And he joins that, that's that list of veteran players that isn't really long on the White Sox. And he's going to be a really formative presence. And Giolito in his own way is too, a really intelligent, personable, giving kind of guy. I think they have a great dynamic, but Abreu is at the center of it all.
What a fascinating lineage of first basemen too, who are de facto, I don't think they have an official captain, right? The Sox don't. So a de facto captain of that team. When you look back, Frank Thomas, first base, Paul Konerko, the first baseman and very prominent personality and leader,
right,
for the 05 World Series team. And then the heir to Konerko is Abreu. That's a fascinating lineage, especially for a team to be built around that position, or not a team to be built around, but for a culture to be built around that position.
Right. It's a real run. And it's funny. It reminds me of, everybody was doing these rankings by, all-time teams in each market. I don't know who was behind it, if it was MLB.com, but it seemed like everyone was doing it for a while there. And in Chicago, people were doing White Sox teams, Cubs teams, or all Chicago teams, and online voting. And it's funny how, the Cubs always overshadow the White Sox in that way because they just have so many more fans. So, it boils down to like Mark Grace versus Frank Thomas. It's not fair. But it was close. So I think Grace probably won, every vote. I'm off track, but that's what it made me think of. It's funny. The White Sox have had, yes, great first baseman, absolutely. Cardinals, well, before, too, right?
The Cardinals have, the Cardinals have had a pretty good run, and then they're wrestling with why Keith Hernandez isn't in the Cardinals Hall of Fame. Eventually, I got to imagine he will be. Either the fans will put him in, or the Red Ribbon Committee will put him in. But he did not go in this year, and it thought was his best chance. Yet was did not do as well in the fan voting. Tommy Herr won, which you can probably appreciate.
Well, they love Tommy Herr, Cardinals fans, right?
Yeah, they do. Yeah,
they love them,
especially of a certain age.
For sure.
So I do want to talk to you about the Cubs, and we'll touch on them, briefly. But first, I want to offer up a line and ask if it's been used yet. So, the White Sox for a long time, I guess in our youth, maybe even before our youth, were known as the Go-Go Sox. So, if this is the current team as you describe it, is it the going gone Sox?
Yeah, that's good. I will use that, and there's a good chance I'll forget to credit the originator. In fact, right now I'm having a hard time remembering who just suggested it. But well, it'll be mine. It'll be my line.
Yeah, no, it's all yours. It's my gift basket for you being on this podcast to give you that line.
Nice. What do they call that when a celebrity appears on a talk show? You get a basket full of gifts. What do you call that? The bag or a? At a bowl game, you get a backpack full of stuff, electronics.
I don't remember.
I got that. It's not bad.
No, not a bad best podcast in baseball gift. Let's close with the Cubs here. Are you, how would you describe their situation? They are a team that was, supposed to be a dynasty, have one title to show for it, did not win the division last year. Had grand plans for 2020 to launch a new television station, a new broadcast entity as part of their identity, have reworked everything around Wrigley Field. It seems like I've heard them described as, because of this delay, in a fragile spot. It certainly seems like they were caught at a pivotal time in their history. How do you view the Cubs, not just on the field, but where they are financially, brand, identity off the field?
I think fragile is a good word for it, and they'll be viewed somewhat harshly if it ends up that they really had one championship and let's say Chris Bryant get away. I don't know if he's signed through next year, but there's a lot of speculation about them potentially trading Bryant. The economics of baseball right now, the uncertainty of it all might make that, who knows, might make it impossible, or might hasten their desire to do so. But you've got Bryant and then Javi Baez right behind him. These are two of the great Cubs. And if they feel like they're going to blow it up and rebuild instead before it's too late, it will not go over well. The thing I always heard people say in this town about the Cubs was, if they can just win once before I die, I can die happy. That's bull. People don't, they won once. And what we learned is that Cubs fans are like every other group of fans. You win one and then you realize, oh, I want that again. And the Cubs have every advantage, right? They had the players, they have the ballpark, they have every seeming inherent ability to contend all the time. And So they are in a very fragile spot. John Lester is on the wrong side of the proverbial hill. They don't have any idea what Yu Darvish will wind up bringing. So far, he's brought little to nothing. And they don't have a Jake Arrieta anymore. They don't have anything more solid to count on than Kyle Hendricks, who's, you know, very dependable in that rotation, but he's not a lead dog. He's not a number one. So the pitching might actually be terrible. I mean, we don't know, but it could be a huge weakness there. And if it is, then they're going to be, you know, they're going to be just another non-contending team. And that would be taken with a lot of bitterness here. The romance around the Cubs, I think, is largely a thing of the past. It's not that it's cynical, but it's as cynical here around surrounding that team. And I'm really talking about Cubs fans, as I think it is when the Yankees don't deliver, or the Red Sox don't deliver, or any other, you know, the Cardinals don't deliver. So the only way to really make good on everything for the Cubs would be to be better than expected, more than meets the eye, and kind of win back that extreme good time that existed around here in 2015, 2016, into 2017. But even in 2017, when they were trying to repeat and they weren't, you know, the class of baseball, it was very different. It was a different vibe around the Cubs, and it has only kind of gotten more tense. So, yeah, fragile is a good word for it.
Boy, so the way you described it, it really seems like their delta or bandwidth or whatever fancy word you want to use of outcomes in a 60-game season is very similar to the way you described the Sox. I mean, if the Cubs pitching craters and they've already got an injury to deal with in Quintana, if it craters, then you could look at a really disastrous season if the offense doesn't get hot and carry it. And whereas you could also see, you know, maybe the Cubs pitching is okay, is fine, is steady, is Hendricksian, is that a word? And yeah, and then their offense gets hot and carries them. I mean, it's hard to think of a lineup that could be more robust and powerful in a short window than the Cubs. But golly, you know, I mean, that's the same situation with the Sox. Get hot, go win, you know, go 40 and 20. Stumble out of the gate, show your youth, strike out a bunch, and go 20 and 40. I mean, a 20 and 40 season, to oversimplify, for the Cubs, that would be disaster, right?
Sure. You know, it would mark the end of John Lester's time. It would mean Yu Darvish has been the I mean, I hate to put these words in something that hasn't happened yet, but he's 7-11 so far for the Cubs. If they're bad, it means he didn't deliver, and if that's the case, he's the biggest free agent bust the Cubs have ever had. $126 million pitcher. And it could mean that they have already begun to, or even successfully, dealt Chris Bryant. You know, a Chris Bryant doesn't just grow on trees. I mean, I think he checks every box that you could want of someone to represent your organization. I find him to be maybe the my favorite athlete in Chicago to deal with. You know what it's like, the grind of talking every day when under normal circumstances. I mean, he's somebody who, for whatever reason, the Cubs have just taken for granted from the start. Service time issues at the beginning and up through now, not extending and really completing those talks. It seems so obvious that a team like the Cubs with the ownership that promised to be so aggressive and brings plenty of money to the table, but doesn't seem to want to spend it. It's just so odd, Derek. And yes, for the Cubs this year, it really blows up. It's unrecoverable.
I think that oddity kind of is a window into where they are financially.
Where they claim to be, right? I mean, I think there's skepticism about that because they own the whole neighborhood. Sure.
Well, maybe where they're acting financially. That's a better way to put it. where they're acting financially.
Where they're acting, right. Which is their, you know, they're right, but again, won't go over well. I mean, the Ricketts were, Tom Ricketts, you know, was the mayor of Wrigleyville, warm and fuzzy, a nice man, mm-hmm. in the stand, shaking hands, celebrated, thanked everywhere he went. He's not a popular guy now. That family's not a popular family on the north side of Chicago. It's just indicative of a certain bitterness or cynicism that surrounds the Cubs in at this time.
I thought the honeymoon might last longer, but I get it. You've traveled the Cardinals-Cubs corridor quite a bit over the last few years. You have some brief thoughts, closing thoughts on which of these teams is better positioned in a 60-game sprint?
The Cardinals or the Cubs? I'm not betting on the Cubs, so that doesn't mean I am on the Cardinals, but I grew up in Chicago as a Cubs fan in the 70s and 80s, and you know, whenever I sort of stopped being a fan and started being an impartial journalist, because of course we know that we are all completely impartial. It's sewn into my fabric to just assume the Cardinals are going to be better than the Cubs. I still, even though it's completely unwarranted, I'm sure, associate the Cardinals with winning close games, making the key, you know, the key at bat, the key defensive play, not screwing up. And I still associate the Cubs with all those negative characteristics. It's probably not grounded in reality, but it's just, it's hard not to view things that way. So I'm not a good analyst of the X's and O's or a roster, probably. I expect the Cardinals to be, you know, to be competitive, to not crater. I don't know if that's true, but I like, you know, I think they have, I believe more in their pitching staff, certainly. It was much mm-hmm. better than the Cubs last year. It should be again, I would think. And, you know, I always think pitching is the key to the whole operation. I do think the Cubs, like you said, have a lineup that can be great, but it has not equaled the sum of its parts for the last couple of years. You know, the Cubs have not hit well with runners in scoring position or, you know, by any of those standards that you call clutch or timely. They haven't. They wait for the home run, even though they have all this perceived individual talent. So they would have to really have a different kind of performance than they've had the last couple of years. And so we'll see if it's in them. I don't know, but I you know, as I look at the Cubs and the White Sox, if I had to bet who's going to have a better record, I felt like I'd bet on the White Sox. So I bet on the Cardinals too, you know, but I don't know them like you do.
You bet on the White Sox. I'm eager to see what it feels like at Wrigley, or how the Cubs, how much that series at the end of last year echoes, where the Cardinals swept the series, claimed the spot in the playoffs, won every game by a run, and just really, it seemed like, you know, that they regained the throne a little bit there. You know, Joe Maddon talked a lot about how you had to prove that you could play at Busch. You had to prove that you could go chin to chin with the Cardinals, and then you had to prove that you could beat the Cardinals, and then he had to prove that you could stay ahead of the Cardinals. He talked a lot about that. And it was like that moment, that series, they had a chance to say, look, Cardinals, this is still our place. And they didn't, dramatically. So last question for you, Steve. You spent a lot of time at Busch back when you lived here in St. Louis and would come out to the Cubs-Cardinals series and do some Cardinals work. So do you miss us? Do you miss being around us? Do you miss being nearby here in St. Louis?
You know, I miss St. Louis. I do. And I think that so we lived in University City for 16 years, raised our kids there. I feel like a lot of people probably do when they live somewhere they're not from, which is, you know, you don't necessarily connect with a region or metropolitan area, but you do with your community. So I absolutely miss the feeling of everything smaller there. You know, I couldn't go anywhere in U City without running into people I knew. I don't have that anymore. We moved somewhere where, you know, we didn't raise our kids and don't have the same feeling in the community, even though I'm from Chicago. So yes, absolutely. I miss it for those warm, familial connections. But I also like St. Louis, generally speaking. I think that it's, I tell people here who can be dismissive of it, that it's better than you think. I always enjoyed my time there, especially the key to it all was once I stopped kind of looking around St. Louis for Chicago, right? Because they're not the same kind of place. Mm-hmm. And they ought not be compared side by side. They're appreciated for their differences, right? So
yeah.
I like them both. And
that makes a lot of sense. Don't look around St. Louis for where you're from. Appreciate St. Louis for where you're at.
Right. That's right.
I like it. Yeah. Well, Steve, thanks very much, man. Thank you very much for joining me here. This has been a pleasure chatting with you, and I hope to see your masked up face at some point in time at Wrigley Field.
Yes.
Or in St. Louis.
It looks better with mask than without. I'll give you that.
That's only because you have a super stylish mask.
Right, right.
The Burberry Novacek really plays off your face.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Nice. Thanks, Steve.
All right, take care.
A special thanks to St. Louis Transplant. Okay, I mean Chicagoan Steve Greenberg of the Chicago Sun-Times for joining me on this episode of the best podcast in baseball. You can find Greenberg on Twitter at SL Greenberg. That's SL Greenberg. And of course, you can find his work in the Chicago Sun-Times at chicago.suntimes.com. That's chicago.suntimes, no hyphen, all one word, .com. You'll really enjoy his columns there. He does great stories. He finds great angles on great stories. And I wasn't even kidding when he's a verbal pugilist. He'll leave some bruises every so often, which is appreciated. And you'll enjoy his beat work, too, on the Cubs as they get ready for a new beat writer there right on the eve of the opening day. You can find all of our Constant Cardinals coverage at stltoday.com and in the pages of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. That includes coverage from Busch Stadium, coverage of the Sim Games, weekly chats with Rick Hummel or myself. Coming up soon, we are going to do a 2020 baseball preview special section. And not to give too much away, but the hope is that the cover of that special section is something that you'll want to clip and save or hang up. Try to think of a way to tease it here. We were able to put together a photo shoot that we hope captures the personality not just of the 2020 Cardinals, but of this era of Cardinals and some of the defining personalities from this era of Cardinal baseball. That special section will also include columns from Benjamin Hockman and Ben Fredrickson, a cover story that I'm working on, also a story about Jack Flaherty that will add to his rise as perhaps the next in the lineage of aces for the Cardinals. Also in there is Rick Hummel's annual breakdown, position by position, of the team, his scouting reports, and new for 2020 will be Rick Hummel's view of the designated hitter for the Cardinals. That's right, the universal designated hitter has arrived. You'll be able to find that special section in the Sunday Post-Dispatch, and I'll talk more about it as it gets closer. But you'll also be able to find it at stltoday.com, where you can also see all the works of my colleagues like Dave Matter on Mizzou, who hosts a weekly chat and a weekly podcast. You can find the best podcast in baseball on iTunes, where you can listen to individual episodes, download individual episodes, or subscribe to the podcast. Subscriptions make the sponsorships possible, and sponsorships make this weekly podcast possible. It would not exist without the community of listeners that have come here and helped us make this podcast what it is over the past 8 years. You can also rate and review the podcast. I do read the reviews. I do go through and read them and try to be responsive to them. Some folks have asked for interviews that are, well, let's say, tricky to pull off right now, but I will continue to try. The Post-Dispatch's Constant Cardinals coverage and the best podcast in baseball intends to go on the road and follow this unnerving, stressful, unusual, shortened, and perhaps re-energizing and invigorating season all the way through. That's our hope. We want to take our readers and our subscribers and our listeners as close to the game as possible. The best podcast in baseball is brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. Update your closets, garage, office, pantry, and more. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BYDESIGN. Closets by Design of St. Louis, the official sponsor of the best podcast in baseball. We'll be back next week with another episode from Busch Stadium. For the best podcast in baseball, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. Talk to you soon. Stay healthy. Stay informed.